Ohio's response to the opioid crisis. It seems like this has come up in just about every presentation we've had so far from the other subject matter experts on Medicaid and education and the economy. So I'm very glad that we asked Director Plouk to come and talk to us today. Tracy Plouk is, as I said, the director of the Ohio Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services. She brings a strong policy background to this role, having been involved in Medicaid as the state's Medicaid chief and with the Office of Budget Management and several other positions. So I will introduce her and we can get started right away.
Okay, good morning everyone, or good afternoon, I guess it is now. I brought a folder of information. I'm not gonna spend any time on this, but just wanted to let you know that there are my presentations on the left-hand side, along with some more recent documents that the administration has created related to the opiate epidemic. And then we've got some service-related information on the right-hand side that you can refer folks who may be in need of some referrals within your districts. I have quite a few slides, and what I'm going to do is go through those. You can throw up a hand and stop me to ask a question if you'd like, and I can address any other related subject questions at the end if I don't hit on something you're interested in, and we'll just go from there. A little bit of background about myself. I'm not a clinician. I've served in this role for 6 years. We have a medical director who is an addiction psychiatrist, an assistant medical director who's an addiction psychiatrist. So if at any point during your terms you have questions personally or you would like some expert opinion, we can make that available to you or your staff. There are sort of concurrent drivers of Ohio's problem, and if you enjoy reading, I would actually suggest a book for you. It's called Dreamland by Sam Quiñones. It describes in very readable terms how the United States, and Ohio in particular, has sort of reached an intersection of the prescription drug challenge and the heroin epidemic at essentially the same time. And there are a lot of vignettes in the book that are focused on Ohio, so I thought that might be of interest to you just for some additional background. And then I want to spend most of the time in the presentation talking about the interventions that we've undertaken in the last 6 years, and we continue to introduce new things as we go forward. This slide here just shows the increase in the number of prescribed medications in Ohio over a period of years relative to the number of overdose deaths. And you can see that there is a notable alignment between those two lines. And we have introduced interventions specifically around prescription drugs, which I'll get into, but this is one piece of the challenge. Heroin, obviously, is the other piece. There is a very organized effort, largely coming out of Mexico, to distribute heroin much the same way one might distribute pizza. And it is much more available, really, in all communities in Ohio. And that did not used to be the case. And so more and more people are finding that their own family, their own friends are affected by this epidemic. And I think that has led to some reduction in stigma, some more openness about the need to seek treatment and make sure that treatment is available. In addition to heroin, though, we have a drug that has been evolving in the last couple of years called fentanyl. And if you've not heard of this, you certainly will during your legislative term. This is a synthetic opiate, and oftentimes people who are taking heroin end up having heroin that's laced with fentanyl and they don't know it. It's much more potent, and the risk of death and overdose is much more significant. And you can see at the bottom some stats that really in a one-year period, we just had a very significant increase in the number of unintentional overdoses in our state that were linked to fentanyl. So we published the comprehensive death statistics once a year. The last ones came out in August of 2016 for the calendar year 2015. And we'll have another in-depth analysis late summer. But obviously, this increase is very troubling. Overall, as far as unintentional overdoses in Ohio, in calendar year 2015, we had 3,050 of them. There were many other overdoses that fortunately did not result in death. And so, I want to highlight that it is not limited just to 3,000 people. But in terms of the number of deaths, somebody's dying essentially once every 3 hours in this state. And so this is extremely critical that we try to do everything that we can to attack the various intervention points related to addiction. And so sort of along that philosophy, Governor Kasich, a number of years ago, established what's known as GCOAT, the Governor's Cabinet Opiate Action Team. And it really covers soup to nuts cabinet agencies that represent interdiction, prevention, treatment, medical oversight, regulatory boards, et cetera, to really make sure that we have a concerted focus on collaboration between the agencies and between the systems so that we're as efficient as possible in our approach. All of you in your districts have ADAM boards, alcohol, drug, mental health boards, and the vast majority of these boards have embraced a concept called a recovery-oriented system of care. That is sort of a comprehensive scale or scope of activities that are funded or supported within a community. Some of them don't take any money at all, like a 12-step program. Others might be community coalitions working together to emphasize different and more certain kinds of treatment, et cetera, and certainly prevention. So you'll hear about recovery-oriented system of care. I just wanted to throw that graphic up there for your reference. But I want to start with prevention today. As a state agency, the Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services supports many different kinds of prevention activities. This picture here is from last, I think, April 30th. We had our annual youth rally on the State House lawn. We had more than 1,800 high school students from all across the state come down and support positive decision-making, positive choices, wellness, et cetera. We also fund quite a number of community coalitions around the state, and we have a youth-led network. So there are adults within schools, might be a resource officer, might be a teacher, that helps to support youth-led prevention and wellness efforts. And we have a network of these young leaders within the district so that they can communicate across districts and share ideas and share excitement. So that's another thing you will likely hear about from folks within your district. The governor has a signature prevention program that was established in 2014 called Start Talking. I wanted to raise this to your attention today because you will be seeing me in the future and hearing more about this. It is comprised of a few different things. We have a voluntary email that we send to folks who sign up, whether it be parents, teachers, et cetera, to share just candid information about various risks and dangers associated with prescription drug or related topics on a biweekly basis. And then parents can use these to introduce conversation with young people in their lives. 5 Minutes for Life is a uniformed officer from local law enforcement, the patrol, National Guard, coming into an athletic team meeting or student council or the band or some other student group and talking about how those youth who are involved in that activity are seen as leaders within their school and how the choices that they're making are affecting the choices that their friends are making. And they ask, you know, really call upon the young people to provide leadership in making healthy decisions. And then for many legislators over the last few years, we have offered to host community meetings in concert with that legislator to talk about the importance of prevention activities. And certainly that offer is extended to all of you as well when you assume office. So with this overall approach, we've been able to connect with more than 100,000 students and 60,000 adults in the last couple of years. So it's not the only prevention program out there. Certainly we support other prevention programs, but this is something that is free and simple and pretty straightforward. So if the governor ever asks you about it, I talk to you about it, and I'll continue to talk to you about it. So I want to change over now to some of the interventions that we've introduced related to prescribers in Ohio. And our state was actually ahead of the national prescribing guidelines that came out within the last year. We actually have three types of prescribing guidelines in Ohio for emergency departments, acute care, and chronic care. And the goal in all of these is to prevent the initiation of drug abuse and ultimately drug addiction. These were all designed in concert with prescribers, the medical associations, the board of nursing, the medical board, et cetera, and went through a very lengthy vetting process. and they were introduced at various points over the last 3 years. The results so far, though, we've actually seen a decrease in the number of opiate doses that has been dispensed over a two-year period, which is, you know, we're not done, but I think that's demonstrating some progress. And also the number of Ohio patients who are receiving high doses of opiates in their prescriptions has decreased by 18%. So again, we're not done, but I think this is positive progress. The Ohio Board of Pharmacy is a resource for you. They run all different kinds of analytics. They have the oversight for the Ohio Prescription Monitoring Program. It's known as ORS, with two R's here in Ohio. And Steve Shearholtz, the director, he can provide you with a briefing. And it's really fascinating stuff, and I think it might be of interest to you. And he goes out and does training for law enforcement and communities, et cetera. So we're continuing to make progress in this area. There has been a mandatory requirement that ORS must be referenced, and you can see that there's been a significant increase in queries to the ORS system by both prescribers and pharmacists in the last couple of years. And again, these are the scheduled drugs that have to be entered into ORS. The governor's office, about a little over a year ago, made an investment to purchase the IT interface between our ORS system and the pharmacy databases and the electronic medical records that are used in doctors' offices, hospitals, pharmacies, et cetera, so that a pharmacist or a physician doesn't have to go into their EMR medical record and ORS separately in two silos, but rather the ORS information could just be pulled into their medical record. And so we're trying to overcome obstacles if people say, oh, it's too difficult to check ORS. And we continue to work on provider education there. You will hear a lot about treatment as a legislator, and I just wanted to start with the clarification that there are actually two types of treatment, both of which involve counseling. One is abstinence-based, and the other one is medication-assisted. And I'm going to go through some of the medication-assisted types of medications here in a few minutes, but Ohio historically has been an abstinence-based approach, meaning that you could not be taking any form of medication, even if it's like a psychotropic drug or something you might use for a co-occurring mental illness, and receive addiction treatment. And over time, we have made changes because the science actually has shown us that if you have medication-assisted therapy in addition to your counseling, you are less likely to relapse, you are more likely to have sustained recovery. So we are now, you know, trying to educate people on the value of medication-assisted treatment if it's appropriate for that person. You have to have both the counseling and the medication, though, if you are going to do medication-assisted treatment. You can't just have the medication and call it quits because the roots of your addiction have not actually been addressed by just using that medication. And we know that without medication-assisted treatment, relapse rates can be as high as 90% within the first year. With MAT, as it's known, the relapse rates are still nowhere near zero, but they are better than 90%. And so I've got a slide in here in a minute that shows the some of the studies that have been done. There are three basic kinds of medication-assisted therapies right now, and I just want to highlight these for you briefly because you'll be hearing about them. Methadone is the most highly regulated form of those. It's also the most long-standing. And if you think about the cost associated with methadone, it is sort of, the cost is sort of pennies, consider it that way. Methadone providers are regulated by the DEA, the Board of Pharmacy, and our department, so pretty highly regulated environment. And people come on site, they receive their dosage, and they receive their counseling. Buprenorphine is a newer form that has been available now for a number of years, but it's not as long-standing as methadone. This is often known as Suboxone, and this is also, like methadone, it's also an opiate itself, but it helps to reduce the cravings to go out and use street drugs. And again, this is offered in association with counseling, and there is a special training that prescribing physicians must undergo, and they are limited of the number of clients that they can see because we have closed down pill mills and we want this to actually be a treatment-based environment. If you think about the cost of Suboxone, think dollars, not pennies, but it is still, you know, relatively affordable. With Suboxone, there is a concern that it could be diverted if it is not highly supervised by the prescriber, and so you will likely hear about that as well. The third kind of medication-assisted treatment is technically known as naltrexone, but the trade name is Vivitrol, and you will hear about that as well. This is not an opiate, and this is a it's not a partial blocker, it's a total blocker. So a person who receives an injection or takes oral naltrexone does not have cravings to use. And if you use heroin, you will not have the effect that you would if you were not using this drug, this medication. If you think about the cost of this, though, this is like $1,000. So they're, you know, this is the one that may be preferred because there's not diversion, but there's also a higher cost. And so what we say is that there is not a single correct path to recovery. There are different things that are more, you know, or less appropriate for each individual based on their own circumstance. But there are different options that are available. And I just wanted to highlight these for you because you'll be hearing more about it. Surgeon General, within the last few weeks, issued a report talking about addiction. There is nothing groundbreaking in this report, but I think they are hoping to use the sort of like the smoking report that came out decades ago and really try to call attention to the destigmatization of addiction and mobilize people to work to help others to achieve recovery. But it does talk about the use of medication-assisted treatment, so I just wanted to call that to your attention. These are some studies about abstinence rates. If you take any type of medication-assisted treatment, there is research to say that it is more helpful to maintain and sustain recovery than without MAT. So each of these rows are three different studies that just shows the comparison to one of the medication-assisted therapies. And if you're interested in more detail about this, I can connect you with our medical director, but just wanted to like basically provide some base level of information today. Medicaid is very helpful to us in the state of Ohio in terms of access to addiction treatment. We actually have a very robust list of services that a person who's Medicaid enrolled can access if they are struggling with addiction. Those are listed here. Again, if you're interested in more information, I can make that available. Our state is currently undergoing a redesign of our community mental health and addiction benefits, and just wanted to put a couple of dates on your radar today. Next July, we are switching over to a completely new set of codes that our providers will use to bill Medicaid, and there'll be some new services and new rates associated with services as well. And then in January of 2018, we are taking the mental health and addiction benefit through Ohio Medicaid, and we're rolling it into our five Medicaid managed care plans. Today, if an addiction provider bills, they bill Ohio Medicaid department directly rather than billing through the plan like the rest of healthcare does. So we're just better aligning our benefit with how the state treats the rest of healthcare. I wanted to talk now for a few minutes about some targeted programs that we have that may be of interest to you because we have some specific investments in specific areas of the state. Pregnant women who are addicted, folks who are justice involved, recovery housing, and peer support. We know that, unfortunately, there are quite a few women in the state who are pregnant and using heroin or prescription drugs, and their babies are at risk, and they are at risk. And so we've partnered with Ohio Medicaid in the last few years to do some demonstration sites that basically helps to connect the mother who is identified as being addicted to an opiate to treatment services, and also in an attempt to make sure she's healthy, but the baby is hopefully born drug-free then because she's been introduced to interventions. And then on the recovery support side, helping to connect that new mom or mother of a new child to work if she's not working, to safe and sober housing if she's not housed, and just really trying to work to meet the needs of that particular mom and family. So we developed a MOMS project, Maternal Opiate Medical Support, and It was a three-year quality improvement initiative. We're now at the end of the 3 years, and we're working with Medicaid to see how we can basically blend this into what the Medicaid managed care plans are doing so we can take it to a broader scale. These were the sites, though, that we had the demonstrations. And if you're interested in really, you know, seeing some programs that have produced positive results, you know, take a tour or learn more about it, I can certainly connect you with that. But we have learned from this project, and we want to make sure that we are taking those learnings into account as we undertake next steps. We also have been doing a series of community meetings, and just looking at this, I see that they're not all on this map, but we have been going out and meeting with county commissioners and treatment providers and sheriffs and others to say, you know, based on what you're seeing, what are your gaps in your continuums? This doesn't include last year's visits. I know we were in Cuyahoga and really a number of other places on there. So if you're interested in us coming out to have a meeting, we can do that, certainly. A little bit about justice-involved Ohioans. Oftentimes, people who are struggling with addiction are either they're arrested because of drug possession or property crimes, potentially, or some other crime that is related in some way, shape, or form to their addiction. And sometimes an arrest is enough to really be that bottoming out point for that person where they say, okay, I am ready now to contemplate treatment. And if you don't try to make that an intervention point, then the person just continues with their addiction and, you know, an opportunity is potentially lost. So we've got some partnerships that are currently underway that I just wanted to highlight briefly for you related to a few different types of justice settings. First of all, with Ohio's prisons, we did something really unique about a year and a half ago. Our department partnered with the Department of Rehabilitation and Corrections, and we basically moved all of the addiction treatment professionals who work in Ohio's prisons onto our table of organization. They became our staff, and we increased by 50%, or about 60 folks, the number of treatment providers who are actually working in the prisons. We also added some additional contracted services within the prisons related to addiction. Gary Moore, actually, at DRC, received a new option through the legislative process to identify nonviolent offenders who are very early in their sentence with DRC and connect them with treatment and then move them out into the halfway house environment in relatively short period of time, maybe like 6 to 8 weeks, and then they can complete their sentence in the community, which is less expensive and helps them to reconnect with the community much more effectively. We also identified new funding for individuals upon their release if they need maybe employment coaching, if they need some limited transportation, some time-limited recovery housing, et cetera, so that their risk of relapse is decreased, their risk of reoffending hopefully is decreased, and we're evaluating that progress as we go forward. And Rehab and Corrections is also partnered with Ohio Medicaid so that as offenders are preparing to leave the institutions, go back to community, if they're eligible, they are able to enroll in Ohio Medicaid, so then they have a payer source for treatment upon their release, and they, again, will have hopefully more luck in succeeding to find a job and certainly to continue with their sobriety. So that's sort of the prisons. County jails have been another area where we have spent quite a bit of time in the last few years. Probably the second year that I was director, I met with some representatives from Buckeye State Sheriff's Association, and they were agitated around mental health and addiction circumstances in the jail. And I thought they were going to say they wanted more training for their officers, things like that. And they said, no, what you need is more housing in the community, because somebody is released from jail, they don't have anywhere to go, they reoffend, and they're back in 72 hours. And we didn't have any resource at that point. But when we eventually consolidated two cabinet agencies, we identified about $1.5 million. And we, with the support of the General Assembly and the governor, used that resource rather than lapsing it to actually make investments with the sheriffs and the Adam board so that we could introduce treatment in the jail setting, fund more diversion programs, fund recovery housing for people as they were leaving jail in an attempt to try to get them connected with the kinds of supports that would keep them out of jail in the future. So that $1.5 million grew to $3 million in this biennium per year, and we're currently funding programs in, I believe, 38 counties. So this has been, I think, popular program. I think that, you know, we've got many examples where the objectives that they set out to serve, you know, a certain number of people have actually been exceeded. And, you know, I think that this is a really important point of intervention. This year, we've also included the community-based correctional facilities in that funding mix if the, you know, other partners agree to support their inclusion. This is a map of where we are currently funding those programs, if you're interested. But you can see it's really all over the state. I also wanted to spend just a moment talking about specialty docket initiatives. We have certified drug courts in many places in Ohio, and more courts are really being certified as the months go on. In the statute, we have some named counties that receive funding if they have a certified drug court in their county border. It could be municipal, it could be common pleas. And so I'll talk a little bit about that program. We also have a program that helps support administrative costs of these specialty dockets. And this could also be a veterans court, mental health court. That piece isn't just limited to the drug courts. The drug court, certified drug court program is known as the Addiction Treatment Program, quite creative title, I know. We did a pilot in 2014 and 15, and what we wanted to do is connect people with treatment who did not have any other payer source. They didn't have Medicaid, they didn't have any private insurance, but they could not really be enrolled in a drug court if they couldn't access treatment. So this helped to fund a gap that was identified by the judges and the courts. It was successful in terms of outcomes, and so it was expanded actually by members of the General Assembly through the legislative process, and there were 13 counties. There were 15 named in the budget bill, two elected to not participate. So we've got 13 that were funded. And we actually expanded to an additional 7 counties just a few months ago because we had some underspending in the program and we had a lot of interest from other areas that could use the resources. So there's a map there of who we're funding. Some of the results, though, from the first year, I thought you might be interested. The median age is about 30. 63% of the individuals also had a mental health diagnosis, which is really not surprising when you consider the trauma and just co-occurring circumstances. And you can see the race and gender and things break down. As far as the recovery, though, there was a significant increase in employment and housing of these individuals who were graduates of the drug court when compared to groups that had not gone through that process. Also, the criminal justice, the recidivism decreased, which was positive. And you can read the rest of these stats, but I think, you know, we saw value in that investment, not only for our system, but for other costs, including criminal justice, child welfare, et cetera, as a result of this investment. Want to switch over now to recovery housing. This is an area where Ohio is now perceived to be a pretty significant leader among states. Representative Sprague, probably about 3 or 4 years ago now, chaired a legislative committee that went around and interviewed leaders, advocates, parents from around Ohio on what needs existed related to the opiate epidemic. And recovery housing was one of those themes. People go through treatment, but if they don't have a safe and sober place to go, then they're likely to relapse. And oftentimes, you know, people who connect with treatment, their spouse, their friends, they're still using, and so it's not really safe for them to re-enter that environment. And here they can live for a time when they build their skills, and then when they're ready to leave, they could go back or they could move somewhere else. We have, with the support of the General Assembly over the last 3 years, been able to establish more than 1,000 opportunities for people to access recovery housing at any given time. That is very significant. Of our Adam Board areas, only 3 have not accepted resources for this purpose, and I know that at least one of those 3 actually has recovery housing available. It's just not funded through the state. So I think this has been an area where we've actually, you know, helped on the recovery support side pretty significantly. Here's a snapshot of what we have actually funded, the Orange counties. You can see the little number is the number of beds, if you will, that was funded by state dollars. But many of the Adam boards fund their, you know, other things. Faith-based communities also fund recovery housing. So this isn't the sole stock that's available in Ohio. And then finally, I wanted to just mention peer support, which is basically an individual who has lived experience with mental health or addiction and is now at a point of stability in their lives, they have the opportunity to be trained on how to give back and help inspire other people. We actually have a curriculum that has been developed. It's a 40-hour course and with some 16 hours of online training that you can take about, information about the disease of addiction or mental illness, ethics, engagement strategies, et cetera. And then these individuals, once trained, they can go and work at a hospital emergency department. They could work for a provider organization. They could work for a recovery center. There are many different kinds of opportunities. And we've trained about 500 folks since July of 2014. And then finally, I wanted to get to life-saving measures. You've probably heard a lot about naloxone or Narcan nasal spray. This reverses the effects of an overdose. And given the increasing potency of the drugs that we're seeing in Ohio's communities, oftentimes more than one dose needs to be administered in order to hopefully save a life. But this basically brings people back into an immediate withdrawal state. So this is not a pretty circumstance. People may come back vomiting blood. They may be ready to fight. And first responders, while they are saving lives by administering this, they're oftentimes dealing with the fatigue of, saving a person, and that person in that moment does not seem very grateful for having just been revived. And I've met quite a few people over the past years where they said, I had to be revived twice, but then I connected with treatment, and now I've got my kids back, and now I'm working. And so, if people say, well, we should just try to save them once and then be done because, they're a druggie, it could be your daughter, it could be your son. So you will likely hear things like that. And I just, if you want any more information about naloxone or Narcan, certainly let us know. There is not a potential for abuse. This is just something that's administered to revive a person. It's not addictive and has no addictive qualities. We are trying, though, to make these kits more widely available in Ohio, recognizing that we want to save lives. And so we have Project Dawn sites that make these life-saving measures available to family or friends or even individuals who are struggling with addiction. And those are oftentimes run by local health departments. The Ohio Department of Health continues to support the establishment of additional places. And I'm seeing Mr. Greenspan there. I know Metro Health Medical Center runs the one in Cuyahoga County, and they're really sort of the leader across the entire state as far as the network of Project Dawn sites. Our department also has a $500,000 earmark to provide naloxone for first responders. And we administer that through the local health department. So if you have police officers, fire, EMS, others within your community that are not receiving naloxone kits from other sources, they can contact the local health department. We've really tried to evangelize this, and there's been quite an uptake in use of the resources. And I know that from last fiscal year alone, that $500,000 ultimately resulted in more than 2,300 saves of lives in Ohio. So certainly not insignificant when you consider that we had 3,050 deaths. We are all over the social media stuff. I would encourage you, as you are identifying your staff, that either you or your staff members could sign up for our newsletter. We have a monthly newsletter that talks about all kinds of training opportunities, policy changes, grant awards that might be of interest to you. We also have a news now that is associated with that. Is there's any kind of breaking news about federal grant awards or something, we send that out, but we don't abuse it and send things every day or anything like that. So I would encourage you to either sign up yourself or suggest a staff member sign up. We are always available to respond to questions, constituent issues. If you have, I can't tell you how many calls I've gotten from legislators who say, so-and-so in my community is trying to access treatment, where do I refer them, that sort of thing. So just feel free to reach out as the need arises. At this point, I'm happy to take any questions you might have. Yes?
Yeah, I noticed you have 895 treatment beds as left of the year.
895 treatment beds.
I saw that right there.
Oh, this is recovery housing. Yeah, so this is that's not treatment. This is state-funded beds for basically like opportunities for people to live in recovery housing. So they are. This is not a treatment center. This is somewhere where people who are now, you know, through the initial phases of treatment, and they are, you know, getting back to work. They're, you know, working toward getting united with their children, et cetera, where they might go.
Through the campaign trail, I heard in my county that there was a need for more beds, more treatment beds. Is that the case statewide?
I will tell you that is something that we hear not infrequently from communities. And the ability that we had to expand Medicaid, I think, helped to provide a payer source for many people. But oftentimes, the workforce to actually treat folks is what the missing link is. So I was in Butler County a few weeks ago, and the Department of Health and the Adam Board are actually going around to all the physicians saying, would you consider being a prescriber of medication-assisted treatment? Because there's a shortage of providers. For detox, we're trying to emphasize like an ambulatory withdrawal management as well. People think about detox as a center where you have to go in order to stop using. And detox in itself is not treatment. It is getting through the withdrawal, and then you initiate treatment. And so there's been, in rural areas specifically, I think about the Northwest Ohio area, there is an organization, a federally qualified health center called Health Partners of Western Ohio. And they have actually moved into a few grocery stores, like in Bryan, Ohio. They're moving into, I don't remember if it's Fulton County, one of the other counties that's immediately east of Williams County, where they're partnering with a local behavioral health provider. So the physician at the health center does the prescribing and oversees the person's withdrawal in a community setting, and then the behavioral health provider actually does the counseling. So they kind of tag team in support of, you know, the group of people in that community who need services. So, you know, as far as detox centers, there have been infusions of resources to expand centers. I think about in Hamilton County, the Cat House just had a $2 million appropriation to build more detox beds at their center. But there's not typically that sort of resource to fund a center-based approach, you know, in each community. So we're trying to look at what other ways, including, you know, having, I would point to Summit County, they're actually taking some of their recovery housing stock and using it as sort of a place for people to stay during that maybe couple of week time period where they're actually withdrawing, but it's medically supervised by a provider who they're going to see every day. So it's, you know, it's not setting up a detox unit, but it is trying to leverage resources that already exist within the community and try to use the providers a little differently to meet the need. Does that make sense? Yes.
The addiction treatment program that you have, that you're funding through some of the counties, I thought there were 11 or 12 counties that were funded. Who receives those dollars, and who's in charge of the program in that county, and how do they sign up?
Yeah, that's a good question. We have the map for that. This is the map as of right now. The yellow counties are the ones we just added a couple months ago. The red counties are the ones that were actually listed in the statute. In addition to the red counties that were listed in the budget bill, Hamilton and Crawford were also named counties. There was a new judge in Crawford County who decided, you know, they weren't pursuing this. And then in Hamilton County, they have a drug court, but it's not a certified drug court. And the language says it has to be certified by the Ohio Supreme Court. So they have not, as of my last knowledge, they haven't actually availed themselves. So legislative action actually built that list of red counties. And I anticipate that over time that list will expand because there's been a lot of interest in this. The funds flow, it's basically like a three-party agreement between the Adam Board, the court, and the treatment provider or providers. So we flow the funds through the Adam Board because that's how we have a natural funding relationship. But it is pursuant to a contract that is actually signed by the court and the participating providers.
Okay, and so is this initiated by the legislature?
Oh, the new ones, actually, our department initiated those because we had underspending that was pretty significant. And so we selected the counties that had the highest penetration of unintentional overdose deaths based on the 2015 data that had not already been named in the legislation.
Okay. So they just need a qualified drug court.
Certified is the word. Yes. And if there's multiple certified courts, like in Franklin County, last I knew, I think there were four that were certified, funding can flow to all four of those. So you just have to have that certification. And I've gotten a question recently from a judge in Southern Ohio who said, well, I don't have a certified court, but I use evidence-based treatment practices associated with my court, so I should be able to, you know, receive these dollars. And it is, you have to be certified by the Supreme Court. So if anybody needs assistance in helping to make that connection with the court, we can certainly do that as well.
Just real quick, the peer support that you, mm-hmm. 500 people that you trained for peer support, are they now getting paid through access to recovery dollars or what?
I'm impressed you know about access to recovery. That's a federal grant. Yes, in cases where we have access to recovery sites, they can be funded through there. They can be funded through Medicaid in some limited circumstances beginning next July when we add the new services. They could be funded by the Adam Board. And some boards have decided to fund a peer, let's say, to work a few hours on a weekend at the emergency department or to work in the peer recovery center to help engage people as they're coming in. So I fund peers actually in all of our psychiatric hospitals that the state administers. All six of them have a staff of peer folks.
Have they tried the model? Like back in the day, they used to have a program called like the ACT team and mm-hmm. things of that nature. Are they using that approach towards the opiate users or?
An ACT team is assertive community treatment. It is a mental health evidence-based practice. So peers are a part of the ACT team. We do not have an ACT service for individuals with only substance use disorder, but in July of next year, as part of our redesign, we're adopting the ASAM criteria, and peers are embedded in that. So if you have a substance use disorder and you have a provider who employs a peer, that would be available to you also, and reimbursed through Medicaid. Yes? Yes. Right now, if I'm Medicaid enrolled and I go to the dentist or if I go to the doctor to have my appendix out, that's funded through CareSource or Molina or one of the managed care plans. If I go for counseling for my mental illness, that bill is sent by the provider to the Department of Medicaid. And so effective next January of 2018, we're making the change so that all of the mental health and addiction services will be paid through the managed care plans. So that's not July, that's next, the following January.
Oh, okay, and just transition the rates.
Yes,
to the code,
yes.
So that they'll be ready to transition in January.
Yes.
Then that's all the providers.
Yes.
Even the contract providers.
Contract providers.
Well, when I say that, it's because unfortunately what we have is people that are moving into the state from other states mm-hmm. who are opening services that, because they know, despite the fact that they're a for-profit, they are getting those dollars. And so my question was, will all of them be in the system? And I am assuming they all have to be.
Yes, and if they're a private, a for-profit opioid treatment program that's trying to move in, they're still subject to the regulation that I described earlier. So they would need to be certified by our department before they could pursue a Medicaid provider agreement. There was a question over here somewhere, I think. Yeah. It's something that we're trying to build, so I don't really have an end game in mind, to be quite honest. We're continuing to get requests for people to be trained, and when we get maybe 20 people in a county or in a region, then we'll go up and offer a training or have a, you know, a contracted entity provide a training.
And that's a standard type training that is done statewide.
Yes. Yeah, and then at the completion of the training, both the 40 hours kind of classroom and then the 16 hours online, everyone has to take a test. And it's an online test, and if you need a special accommodation, you know, because you're blind or what have you, you know, we can make that accommodation. But at that point, we would say that you have officially, you know, been trained as a peer in Ohio. Yeah, the way that we array this among the 88 county health departments is everybody gets a threshold amount, and I don't remember exactly what the amount is, but let's call it $3,000. I'm making this up. But then beyond that, we give based on the population of that county. So, but if Butler County needs more because they've used all of their supply, the county health department can call our office and we can make more available. We've redirected some resources internally to, you know, try to make sure we're meeting the need. And we have not, I mean, knock on wood, encountered any, you know, inability to do so to date. But it all goes through the county health department. So, you know, any of the jurisdictions. And in many cases, like the county health department might use other funds to provide these resources, or the Adam board might pay, the local hospitals in some cases make kits available. So it just kind of varies depending on the area. Yeah.
I do truly appreciate the education piece of it, and making sure that our students understand. Of course, we've been telling kids to say no to drugs for 40 or 50 years. What are we doing to put ourselves out of business, or to at least stabilize those numbers so that those dollars that are being spent will show us the kind of outcomes that we can see that the numbers are going down? Because it's people are being impacted disproportionately, unfortunately, and so a lot of the negative impact is coming back in the same neighborhoods who have always been impacted. And so those are the kind of things that there has to be some sort of stabilization, or otherwise all of that still gets thrown into the Pill Hill kind of areas, and those things have to be stabilized too.
Yeah, and I very much agree with your point that stopping the initiation of drug use is really the most cost-effective and the healthiest thing to do,
sure,
you know, for the future. We are actually looking, we just submitted our budget proposal for the next period that's being reviewed right now by the State Budget Office and the Governor's Office, but I have taken to heart that increased emphasis on prevention is absolutely imperative, and so we're trying to reflect that. And we're also trying to focus on evidence-based prevention approaches, you know, where there's actually been studies to say this works, because oftentimes people say, oh, I want to go in and, you know, talk to people and, you know, scare the kids, and that's, you know, the science does not support that. So we want to focus on evidence-based prevention. But, you know, this is a progressive disease, and if you have someone who's currently addicted, I mean, it's either connection with recovery or death ultimately. And so, you know, this going upstream is important, but we still have to continue to focus on the people who are struggling today. So it's kind of a both and. I don't know that I really answered your question, but
I hear exactly what you're saying. The issue is that somewhere in there, the people who are being addicted, unfortunately, I met somebody who was addicted and they were 40 years old, worked mm-hmm. real hard, had done all kinds of things right, and then all of a sudden it's like, you're doing what? Does that make sense? So somewhere in there, there's still another little disconnect as to who those needing to be educated really are, and a lot of times it's not that parent or that high school student. It is many times, all of us know that the high school students are, but somewhere in there, the people that I see and where I know they're dropping the needles, these aren't high school kids that have been there.
Yeah, and I have a relative who, you know, member of his church, father of many children, and got addicted to pain pills and was searching in dumpsters before, you know, he was able to connect with recovery. So I totally recognize that. Also, I've been surprised at the number of young people who've said that their parents are actually the people who introduced them to drugs. And so I think recognizing that the family is not always there to support the young person, because oftentimes other family members are dealing with this, you know, of their own addiction, that really complicates matters as well in some circumstances. So I'm not bringing good cheer at this moment to close out the meeting, but. Yeah, that's a good point. The Attorney General has been doing a series of regional hearings with a very large committee of interested parties, actually, on this, and they're going to have their report available, as I understand it, by the end of the calendar year. We just met with their staff last week, so thank you for sharing that. Okay. Well, I appreciate the time today. I look forward to working with all of you on this and other very difficult issues.